All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, guys, on the line, I've got the great Patrick Coburn from The Independent, independent.co.uk, and the author of a bunch of great books, including The Age of Jihad. Welcome back to the show, sir. How are you doing?
Great. Good to be back.
Good. Good to talk to you, as always, Patrick. A very important article here about Iraq. Iraq will be hit harder by the oil price drop than by coronavirus or ISIS. And so, yeah, it sure is. Because of the lockdown worldwide here, the demand for oil has just fallen completely through the floor. And for a country like Iraq, they're just about entirely dependent on oil revenue to make everything go there, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, there's really nothing else. You go to the market in Baghdad or anywhere else in the country, you know, you find that absolutely everything comes from elsewhere. You know, you want to buy an onion, you want to buy a watermelon. These come from Iran or Turkey, anything more sophisticated. You know, it's sort of clothing, Turkey, you know, or from China or somewhere like that. There's almost nothing produced locally. So they're about 90% dependent on oil revenues. But I think what's interesting also that this is in Iraq, this is, you know, it's dependent. But actually all the oil producers are the same. You know, Saudi Arabia, and although they say they're trying to develop or have been trying to develop other economic activities, they're completely dependent on oil. So if we're looking at a long-term collapse in the oil price, we've had collapses before, but nothing as radical as this and likely to be as long as this. You know, this I think we're seeing a historic change that in the 1970s, we had the rise of the oil superpowers, you know, Saudi Arabia and the others, and that's going to go into reverse.
Yeah. Well, and that really could lead to massive instability, as you said, not just in Iraq, but throughout the entire Gulf region, right?
Yeah, because these are states, you know, in some ways they're different, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, but they have some things in common that a big chunk of the population work, or at least are paid by the government. There are about 4.5 million people in Iraq. It's the main source of employment. Similarly, in Saudi Arabia, that's what you want to do, work for the government. I mean, you may not do much work, but you get paid. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, this costs a lot of money. It's in April in Iraq, I think they needed $5 billion to just to meet salaries and pensions and that sort of stuff. And they got about, you know, $1.4 billion. No, they got some reserves, but you run through those pretty fast if you're, you know, if the gap is that big between what you need and what you're getting in terms of revenue.
Yeah, well, maybe they can just ask the Federal Reserve to create another trillion for them.
Well, you could do that. I mean, you could go and borrow it, you know, and that's what the oil producers will try to do, you know, and they'll sell assets overseas. But this will be true of Saudi Arabia and Iraq, you know, they'll try to borrow, you know, that maybe you can do things like, you know, cut salaries. It's difficult and dangerous to cut jobs because at that point you really start hitting people. But they could cut, there's talk in Baghdad of cutting salaries by 20 or 30%. Mm-hmm. And that might happen. You know, it's a real bind. And particularly in Iraq, you know, we've had these very violent protests since last October. And we've had about 700 dead and protesters killed and 15, 20,000 wounded. Now, that rather ebbed away at the beginning of the year with the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Mm-hmm. By the U.S. at Baghdad airport. And then we had, of course, coronavirus and curfews. But some of these protests are coming back, and a lot of these people are basically looking for jobs, you know, and if there are going to be no jobs for them, then that sort of protest is going to go on. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is really stirring the pot in the Middle East in general, but particularly in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And now when you talk about those protests from last fall, I mean, that was in good times when the money was still coming in, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was there the night they started, you know, it was a complete surprise. There have been demonstrations actually for 2 or 3 years, but they weren't, you know, they weren't really getting off the ground. And then the security forces and various sort of paramilitaries opened up and killed 10 people and then went on shooting people. But it was very much generated by this very violent reaction. I think it was probably pushed by Iran, thinking that they were facing a sort of velvet revolution against in Baghdad. They weren't. And they sort of created the situation they wanted to avoid. Yeah. But, you know, there's a restiveness. You could see the same thing happening in Lebanon, potentially, you know, in a lot of other countries. That one of the reasons these oil producers, you know, dictatorships, one of the reasons they're stable, that quite a big chunk of the population has got a stake in the system. And if they find they're not getting the money, then they don't have that stake and they'll react.
Yeah. Well, and importantly, that protest movement was almost entirely among the Iraqi Shia, the supermajority that if anybody's represented by the Baghdad government, it would be them. I even read a thing where some Sunnis out in Fallujah in the West were saying, hey, we're sitting this one out. We don't want the government to point the finger at us and blame us for being agitators or call us ISIS or anything. We'll go ahead and let this movement go on, kind of representing them, but not directly in their name.
No, exactly. It's they had the kind of supported it, but they could see, first of all, if the government previous government was repressing it, the Shia population, that badly, they thought, what the hell will they do to us?
Right.
You know, it's going to be a lot worse. And it also won't do us a lot of good, because then the government will say, it's all Islamic State. It's all Daesh. ISIS back in business. Mm-hmm. Supporting, very wisely, they sat that out. You know, we've had things, you know, Iraq either tends to be leading the news agenda 24/7, you know, when Soleimani was shot, when the U.S. had 138,000 troops there, etc., or it completely disappears from the news agenda.
Right.
And at the moment, of course, practically everything's disappeared from the news agenda apart from coronavirus. But there have been important changes there. We've got a new government under Mustafa al-Kadhimi. This is sort of an attempt to have a new start in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit more about that. This guy, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, he's the first prime minister to not be from the Dawa Party or the Supreme Islamic Council, right?
I'm not sure. I don't actually know if he was a member of Dawa. He wouldn't be far off. He's sort of, you know, one of the problems about Iraqi politics or commentary on Iraqi politics is people tend to sort of stereotype it. At the moment, they're saying Mustafa al-Kadhimi, close to the U.S., sort of secular, liberal. Yeah, he is. I know him pretty well. He's a sort of liberal-minded guy, you know, but he's very much part of, you know, his Shia, you know, long-term opponent and militant opponent of Saddam Hussein. You know, nobody who wants to stay in business in Iraqi politics can really be 100% identified with the U.S. or indeed with Iran. You know, you need to cover all the bases, which he'll do. You know, he's a pretty smart guy. But, you know, as everybody who's ever tried to do it has discovered to their cost, that ruling Iraq is really difficult business. And this is a particularly sort of dire moment because there isn't enough money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he sure became prime minister at a bad time when everything is completely drying up like that. But I guess I had read that there were some in the American government who were looking at his appointment as a kind of victory for them, as, you know, he was a less Iranian-tied figure than some of the others or something like that. Is that just unwarranted optimism on their part?
Well, you see, you know, he's quite close to them. He was in London. I think he's a British Iraqi citizen. He lived in London for a long time. But I think that probably the way the Iranians look at it is they want the Shia bloc to remain in power. And he's a Shia from that bloc. That's the most important thing for them, to remain in power in Baghdad. Then anybody who wants to do that has to have relations with the US and Iran, even if they keep quiet about it. So you see, for instance, the current president, Barham Saleh, used to be one of the Kurdish representatives in Washington, speaks very good English, was always associated with the US, but it was the Iranians who okayed him as president, somewhat to people's surprise, because they want, you know, they want, from his point of view, if you're going to have that sort of position, then you've got to have relations with Tehran and Washington. You may try and sort of keep it a little undercover, but you have to do that. So that's true of the of Al-Khadami, the new prime minister, as well. So it's, you know, it's a Shia bloc. He's just reappointed an important general called Abdul Wahhab al-Sadi. He was one of the guys who recaptured Mosul. But again, you know, I mean, he's a Shia general. You know, there isn't going to be a great shift, I think. What they'll try to do is not have Iraq continue to be the arena in which the U.S. and Iran confront each other. But I don't think you'll see them switching radically against Iran or vice versa. They'll also want to get U.S. troops out, but on a sort of fairly friendly basis.
Well, yeah. Now, so speaking of which, in terms of American tensions with Iran in Iraq, the latest was just a few weeks ago. There was another rocket attack or two on American bases, allegedly by Shiite militias. And the news here was that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, was urging Trump to attack Iran over it. And he said no, based on the public relations aspect, that he thought it would look too bad to do that when Iran was in the midst of the coronavirus crisis there. But it looks like there's still a danger of blows in Iraq escalating into war with Iran there. What do you think is the current level of tension?
Well, it's not, you know, that's the problem with the Trump administration, you know, that Trump has, in, you know, Trump has not actually started a war, and certainly not with Iran since he, you know, in the years he's been in the White House. But the guys around him don't necessarily think like that. So one always feels at some point they may do something which could provoke that, though they might not necessarily want it. But, you know, these guys are very crazy, you know. I mean, Pompeo, they don't know anything much about Iraq or Iran. So it'd be quite easy for them to go over the edge. You know, we almost saw that at the beginning of the year when Soleimani was assassinated. And then when you had this rather remarkable thing of Iran, you know, firing missiles at U.S. bases and the U.S. doing nothing about it, except denying anybody that was hurt, which turned out to have been untrue. You know, but it is... It struck me at the time that nobody seemed very astonished that you had the Iranians actually sort of sending missiles rather accurately into U.S. bases. And the U.S. sort of, you know, the White House says, well, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
You know, they could escalate things. It's so sort of quirky. The Iraqis will try to avoid that happening. Coronavirus probably made it more difficult to do.
Apparently, the general in charge of the Iraq war sent a memo back to D.C. saying we cannot do this. We'd be picking a fight with our friends in the Iraqi army.
Yeah, it's quite easy to make a misstep, you know, that, you know, this general who's been appointed head of the counterterrorism service, whose dismissal came just before the riot started last year and may have been connected with the with that, is back, you know, and they're saying a pro-American general. But, you know, it's really not as simple as that. The pattern of Iraqi politics is, and has always been, that you have lots of centers of power in Iraq, and it's always a mistake to try and put any of them out of business, because if you do, they'll come back at you and they'll unite with other centers of power. I don't think that Iraq will change its position very much. On the other hand, it needs the the U.S. has just renewed a 120-day waiver to getting for Iraq to get electricity and gas from Iran, which it needs to keep the lights on. Mm-hmm. But one's always waiting for them, you know, to sort of slightly to overstep the mark, that could happen. And Iraq itself, you know, what's it going to do about this shortage of money? Well, probably borrow. It has some reserves, but these, you know, it's being squeezed, and this is going to be long term. You know, it's difficult. The price of oil came back a bit in recent days, but just in the longer term, you know, presumably one's going to not see people use as much gasoline.
Hold on just one second. Be right back. So you're constantly buying things from Amazon.com. Well, that makes sense. They bring it right to your house. So what you do, though, is click through from the link in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. Won't cost you a thing. Nice little way to help support this show. Again, that's right there in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published 3 great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, the Scott Horton Show interviews 2004 through 2019, interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the Good Doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. You need stickers for your band or your business? Well, Rick and the guys over at thebumpersticker.com have got you covered. Great work, great prices, sticky things with things printed on them. Whatever you need, thebumpersticker.com will get it done right for you. Thebumpersticker.com.
But now, so what's the state of the Sunni-based insurgency in the western part of the country? I mentioned U.S. troops getting attacked by Shiite militias at their bases there, but they're at those bases to fight with those Shiite militias against the Sunni militias, what's left of the Islamic State, right?
Yeah, and also support the U.S. position in Syria, across the border in eastern Syria. I think it's a bit exaggerated. You know, it makes a good headline to say, you know, ISIS back in business, Daesh back in business, because people, you know, at its height, ISIS dominated the news agenda, you know, for long periods, you know, and they did deliberately through their atrocities. But, you know, the Islamic State, like the caliphate that they declared in 2014 when they captured Mosul and held most of western Iraq and eastern Syria, you know, that's gone. You know, they have militants around. There are attacks in north and west of Baghdad. There's a bit of an uptick in these recently, but these are generally pretty small compared to what we used to see. You know, it'll be an attack on an outpost, an attack on a convoy, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 dead, but not these sort of multiple attacks we used to see a few years ago. And people saying, aha, but it's like 2014, they'll come back in the same way. Not really, to my mind. ISIS, you know, they depended on having the element of surprise. They depended on having a power vacuum in eastern Syria because the Syrian government had withdrawn. Syria was in turmoil because of the civil war. There was in Iraq, there'd been a sort of big civil discontent by the Sunni. So there isn't a power vacuum to fill. And also ISIS was defeated. You know, at one point, you know, these guys claimed that God was with them and they were winning these wonderful Napoleonic victories. That isn't happening anymore. So it's significant, but it's not happening. You know, it's not sort of ISIS coming back in the way it did. And it would be very difficult for it to do that.
Well, and so speaking of which, I mean, at this point, Syria aside, when it just comes down to the fight against what's left of the Islamic State insurgency there in Iraq, could the Americans just leave and leave it to the Iraqi army and the Shiite militias to handle what's left of the problem there?
It probably could. I mean, the crucial thing has always been with the U.S. presence is air power. You know, this is a big area to control. From the Iraqi point of view, or the across the border where the Syrian Kurds are, and their strength is to be able to call in the U.S. Air Force. But even if they couldn't do that, it would change things against them, but it wouldn't sort of change things decisively. So there's still. You know, they have people hiding out in the desert. They have areas, you know, deserted villages. There are a lot of refugees they can recruit from. I mean, Sunni refugees. But they don't have at one point they had genuine popular support in the Sunni community. I don't think they have that anymore, partly because people know what happened last time and don't want to suffer another defeat. So, it's a long way around to answer your question, but the answer is, yeah, it wouldn't decisively change things if the U.S. totally withdrew, but it would be make their life easier for ISIS if they weren't under air attack the whole time.
Yeah. And now, are the Kurdish Peshmerga still involved in that fight or not?
They always say they are. And in Iraq, the Peshmerga... They've never been, you know, they always sort of talk a big game, but they've never been that much involved. Somebody who knew a lot about them, a friend of mine always used to call them, you can call them Peshmerga, call them the Peshmelba. You know, they never actually did that amount of fighting. The PKK, well, they don't call themselves PKK, but the so-called YPD in eastern Syria, the Kurdish fighters there, they're much more formidable army there. They do a lot of fighting and are very tough. But there's a contrast between the Kurds in northern Syria and northern Iraq.
Mm. And now, well, speaking of which, on the Syrian side of the border there, the Americans are still occupying the oil fields. And who are they keeping out? The Syrian government? Or are there any ISIS types that they still have to fight?
Well, ISIS would like to get back there. I mean, the Kurds have the oil. There's a big sort of black market in oil there. Well, it's very visible. I mean, I sometimes read stuff in the papers saying, you know, oil is being smuggled from those areas. They have the oil there, but they don't have a refinery. So if you want to get it refined, a lot of it goes to a Homs refinery in government-held territory. So a lot of the Kurdish oil then goes to Assad government-held territory, goes to the refinery there, and then comes back. Both sides benefit. You sometimes see this referred to as smuggling, but actually you stand on the main road, on the Euphrates, just near the Euphrates there, which I've done. There's a continual stream of oil tankers coming backwards and forwards. There's no attempt to conceal this. A lot of that stuff goes into Iraq, too, is refined in the Kurdish area. That always happened. You know, there's a sort of, there's an enormous black economy in both countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, as long as we're on Syria, what's the status of the conflict in the Idlib province at this point?
Well, you know, it's quieted down now. You don't have a government offensive like before, after a sort of one more agreement between Turkey and Russia. The rebels in Idlib lost quite a lot of territory. You know, got very badly hammered by the Syrian Russian air forces. But it's sort of quieted down. I imagine that Assad feels that he can sort of have a sort of salami tactics. Whenever things allow him to do so, he can sort of chop off a bit more of it. The bit that remains is more and more under Turkish control, although the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is used to be called al-Nusra, which used to be, says now it has no links to al-Qaeda, but who knows. But they're more and more squeezed. I think less and less sort of interest in the West in keeping them going. Assad, you know, severe sanctions, but, you know, very firmly in power, some infighting at the top in Damascus within the top of the regime. But that probably reflects the fact that they don't feel under pressure as they used to.
Yeah.
But nothing quite settled, you know. You never quite, you know, one of the many mistakes of the U.S. and the West in Syria was to think, you know, okay, we don't quite want Assad to lose and ISIS to win, the Islamic fundamentalists to win. That's bad news for us. But we don't want Assad to win. So, you know, we'll basically let this go on. You know, well, what came out of it? Well, that's one of the reasons that ISIS developed, you know, is allowing the war to go on there. That's one of the reasons why, you know, you ended up with so many refugees not going home and going into Europe, you know, which had big political effects in Europe. So it seems to me they're making the same mistake as before, thinking that you can have Syria sort of gripped by a sort of permanent crisis and war, and that doesn't matter. The lesson in the past is that very nasty things come out of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like for the Turks' part, they didn't too much mind all the nasty parts coming out of back in the jihadists. But at this point, when the war is essentially over, what motive does Erdogan have to continue to keep the al-Nusra guys in play there?
Well, he's sort of, it's one of the cards they've got, you know, that they control that bit of northern Syria. He's always, you know, he crossed the border against the Syrian Kurds, which is what he's really concerned about. Turkey wants to be a player there. But I'd agree, they don't get that much out of it. You know, it's sort of, they're involved in that particular mess. And maybe they'll advance again. You know, they're practicing ethnic cleansing in part of driving out the Kurds in different parts of northern Syria, replacing them with refugees from Damascus and elsewhere. You know, it's a messy, nasty situation. Again, it's something that disappears off the world's political radar for long periods, even more so this these days because of the COVID-19. And then suddenly you have a big explosion. People say, oh, we're about to go to war, you know, like you did when you had a Turkish invasion last year. You know, lots of nasty things can come out of this.
Yeah.
I think it's slightly more likely because the attention of the world is sort of diverted elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, there would certainly be plenty of attention if it was Assad that was back in al-Qaeda in the Idlib province instead of Erdogan.
You betcha, yeah. And then, you know, you just feel that sort of Pompeo, you know, this sort of, at some point, the crackpots will do something that will, you know, lead to a more general conflict.
Yeah. I think that's really right about the crackpot angle there. You know, when I mentioned that kind of memo back that the general in Iraq had written about the danger of fighting the Shiite militias there, it seemed like he was really taking the opportunity to teach them who are the shirts and who are the skins and and which side we're on over there and what it would mean for us to pick a fight with the side we've been allied with all this time. And that he seemed to understand that Pompeo and probably Trump did not understand who's on whose side over there and what it would mean for them to turn the war against the Shia. And so he had to kind of teach them the 101 on the situation.
Yeah, I think so. The Iranians, usually in Iraq, either the U.S. or Iran or some other foreign power gets overconfident and overplays their hand. The Iranians last year were overplaying their hand. Soleimani appears to have been the guy responsible for the very violent repression of the Shia protesters, which was, catastrophic from the Iranian point of view, because Iraqis blamed Iran for all these, unarmed protesters who have been gunned down. That sort of ebbed away at the moment. So it may be that, things will get a bit quieter. But, every so often, the White House decides to pump up the confrontation with Iran, and that could happen at any moment again. And the Iranian, if you push the Iranians, then the Iranians probably getting a little bit of confidence back. They could attack elsewhere like they did last year when they attack the Saudi oil industry. The temperature is still very high there, and it could sort of detonate something at almost any moment.
Yeah. Well, and there's been all these riots breaking out in Lebanon over the financial crisis there. And I don't know whether they have the same, currency problems in Iraq and Syria. But as we're talking about here, they're going to all have one sort of financial crisis or another here when the whole world is going through one, and they are such oil-centric economies. Or I don't know about Syria. I know they rely somewhat on oil. They're all going to be hit pretty hard by this thing. They all already are, right?
Yeah. I mean, these are, one way to think about these oil states, they're a bit like sort of Tammany Hall. They provide, everybody knows about how corrupt they are at the top. Lots of money is stolen by the guys at the very top. But then below that, you have millions of people who have well-paid jobs in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Dubai or somewhere, Abu Dhabi, that don't do much. That gives a certain sort of stability to these places. Even with all these protests in Iraq last year, you had people who, a lot of people who got decent jobs, they weren't protesting. When I say decent jobs, they got paid. The problem about these oil producers is that if you can get a job with the government, that's fine. And you can do that if you belong to the right sect, if you're Shia, if you belong to the right political party. Government ministries tend to be the sort of cash cows of different political movements. So you're fine if you're plugged in there. But if you aren't, then you're nowhere. You've got a real problem. Before these protests, outside the foreign ministry, I found guys there who had their sort of, they were in a camp and they'd been on a hunger strike, and who failed to want to get jobs in the foreign ministry. That was their one demand. And, if you don't have the right connections, you don't have that job. You can be unemployed for decades during your life. And that's one of the things that tests is this sort of desperate need for jobs, which the government just can't provide. And it's going to be, I think the new government and Al-Kadhimi will be, these are pretty smart guys. The new finance minister is pretty good and so forth. But, at the end of the day, if the money isn't there, it isn't there, so a problem. They're obviously a real problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time again on the show, Patrick. Always great insight.
Good to talk to you. All the best.
All right, you guys, that is the great Patrick Coburn from The Independent. That's independent.co.uk.
and also is the author of The Rise of Islamic State, Chaos and Caliphate, The Age of Jihad, and many other great books as well.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.